from the Australian Health Coach Podcast. How you going, buddy?
Yeah, good, mate. How about yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad at all. We've got some sick kids, but other than that, life's good.
Hiding out indoors, so, making sure they're all right moment.
It's a bit cozy in here, so.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, your herp room gets pretty cool down there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, yeah. I've got an aircon in there now, so if it does get too cold, I can just kick that on, so.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Do you want to do the honours of introducing tonight's guest, or shall I?
You can do it, mate. I'm hopeless at introducing people. I'll probably which is something for sure. So,
Well, tonight we're very lucky to have Elizabeth Randall from Chiquito's Critters on. How are you doing, Liz?
Yeah, not too bad. Thanks for having me on. Very excited.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a cold night. Cold night here in Brisbane, so.
What are you kind of sitting at up there at the moment? Is it kind of like low 20s or are you hitting the teens yet?
Yeah, low 20s at the night. It's getting about 16, 17 degrees. But I'm like a reptile. If it gets anything below like 28, I'm like shivering. So I like to keep the room pretty warm.
Good stuff. Yeah, I can imagine that. I'm definitely kind of the same. I don't like when I have to put socks on.
I live in thongs and shorts all year round, so I think I'm
You should come up here.
Yeah,
you'd be nice and cozy. You'd never have to wear a beanie again, mate.
No, that's it. My head would be perfect.
Oh, Liz, well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, how you kind of got started in animal keeping and, you know, give us a little bit of history on yourself.
Yeah, so I've been interested in animals since as long as I can remember. As like a little 4-year-old girl, it was actually when Steve Irwin died. I was absolutely like just distraught. I was so upset. And my granddad who raised me, he went and bought a toy macaw parrot, and it had like little buttons you could record things, it would talk back and all this. And from then on, I've just loved birds. I've always loved dinosaurs, so it just kind of the dinosaurs and the birds went to the reptiles, and like we always used to go camping and stuff. So I'd see, you know, big lace monitors walking around or big sand goannas, and you'd be like, oh, that's really cool. Follow the tracks, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then got my first snake when I was seven or eight. That was over in WA. We used to live in Western Australia. So got a Simpsons python, and it just kind of went from there. And then once we moved to Brisbane, it just boomed. I got another snake. It was a coastal carpet python, and I had that for about a year, just the one, and then the one went to two, and the two I found another pair for sale, so then I was like, oh, I'll give breeding a crack, and they went to four, and then it kind of just snowballed for the rest of the way. So I think now I'm sitting at over 130 reptiles at the moment.
Whoa.
Yeah, so it went big pretty quick. Yes. So I've been keeping I've been in Brisbane for about 7 years, keeping and breeding for about five years now. So each season is just like getting more things, and yeah, just I've always liked a broad range of stuff. So first it was the carpet pythons, and then doing the different morphs of carpet pythons, and then went into the green tree pythons, monitors, my lace monitors. I've just adored monitors. Like, since I've got into reptiles, monitors have just been like the animals to get. So it, once I got the monitors, it's kind of just kept going. So, and now this year I was able to get my hands on some green tree monitors. So I've got a pair of them now, and they are working. So they're wicked animals. They're so different. Like the Laceys, you can see the big boy up there. He's, lace monitors are very monitor-esque, right? Like you think of a monitor, it's like a Lacey. But the green tree monitors, they're very cat-like in how they move and how they do things. And it's really interesting to see the difference, because I've got a freckle monitor, I've got Ackies, and this is a difference. They're so split apart from everything else. Even the freckled, like the freckled acts more like a lace. And then the green tree monitors are just, very cat-like is the best way to describe it. So they're definitely one of the pinnacle reptiles for me. And to finally get my hands on them, I was just, I was so excited. Like, for once we got the plane ticket booked, like for the animals to come down from Cairns from Aaron Hopper, oh, I was just like, oh, so giddy. I was messaging Aaron like, oh, I'm so excited. So, but no, they're wicked. So,
how old are you? How old are they?
So they are. They hatched in July last year, so not a year old yet.
Yeah, not perfect.
So they were pretty confident. When I got them, they were pretty confident. Like one of them would. It's definitely a boy. It, like, you can see the hemipenal boulders already. He's got the snout boulders. Like, he's definitely a boy. He's getting really cocky at the moment. And, like, I'm holding him. I can hold him now. I can pat him. I can give him scratches on his back, and he's really calm. And then the one we think is a female, she's starting to come there now. Like, she'll let me hold her in the enclosure. I can't get her out yet. But, no, they're so cool. And, like, to be able to work with them. And I think they're easier to calm down than the Laceys. The Laceys took a bit more, whereas like the Greens, they're very inquisitive. And instead of going straight to like aggressive defensive, they'll just be like, oh, I'll just suss you out a little bit. They bolt a lot more though than a lot of the Laceys. So it's kind of like the Tristis almost that, you know, that they're so fast. They'll just ping off anywhere, you know, like and they can jump really far. So, like my female Lace, she tends to jump a bit, but, like, the Grand Tree Monitors are just something else. Like, they flatten their body out when they jump, and they can grab onto it with their tail. Like, yeah, they're just the coolest things.
But, really adapted for that canopy life, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. They're just so cool. Like, I've seen them as I'm feeding them, you know, they'll jump out, but, like, they'll jump out of the enclosure, but they'll wrap their tail around a branch to hold them in. Like, it's just... It's so cool. Like, the prehensile tail is, like, fully prehensile. Like, I've seen the Laceys do a little bit. Like, when they, you know, come off a log or something, they'll, like, kind of use their tail to slow them down, but nothing like them. They're just a whole new ball game.
Yeah, they're a freaking KPA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a shame you just can't, hey? Like,
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. But
hopefully,
because a lot more people are starting to get them now and work with them. So fingers crossed that, you know, we can get them on our license down here and keep them. I mean, it's the same with the on-pelly pythons as well.
You guys can't keep on-pellies down there?
No.
Oh, wow.
But we can keep wild-leaf pythons, though. Think of that one.
the laws are so weird in each state.
Yeah.
Like, it's a bit, it's a bit crazy.
Yeah, it's a bit of a backwards thing. I reckon it would never happen, but it would be great to have like a national sort of license per se, just to be able to kind of open up, you know, a little bit of freedom trading between states and stuff like that, and kind of just make it a bit more universal. But yeah, never going to happen.
That'd be the best, especially for WA. Those poor guys over there.
Yeah.
Like,
and Tassie. Yeah.
And Tassie. Christ.
And Tassie, I had a guy come up from Tassie to my expo, and we had a booth there, and I had some black-headed pythons there, and this man was, like, nearly crying over these black-headed pythons because they're his dream species. I was the only one at the expo with them, and, like, he's just like, oh, you know, I'm from Tasmania. We can't keep them, like, and he was explaining to me the license over there, that they can just take venomous out of the wild with no license whatsoever and just keep them, but you can't sell them.
Yeah.
Like, it was just ridiculous. So, yeah, I let him hold the black-headed python, and he was just absolutely wrapped, like, this little snake in his hand, you know, he was just so excited.
But that's kind of what it's all about too, isn't it? Like, seeing that excitement on someone's face, like, it doesn't get better than that, I reckon.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not often that you find that in adults, you know, like, a lot of them will try to keep, you know, calm down, but, like, he was just, like, he was so excited, you know. And, like, usually, like, there's a no-touch rule at the expo. But I was like, oh, you know, he's come up from Tassie, you know, like, I kind of, I'll let him have a hold. Because he's never been able to find anyone, like, up here at zoos or anything that can hold a black-headed. So I was like, oh, there you go. And he was just so happy about it. Like, and you get all the kids come up and, you know, all the kids are super excited to, you know, tell you what their favorite reptile is and, you know, and question you. Like, I had some kids come up to me that, you know, they were like, oh, that's a green tree python. I was like, yeah, it is. And then they were like, an adult was like, oh, but it's yellow. Why is it yellow? It's supposed to be a green tree python. And this little kid was like, no, they change color when they're a year old. And I was like, yeah, they do. And like, it was just so cool to see like this little kid just like educate the adults, you know. I was just like, oh, like this is what it's about, you know.
Yeah. So I have a feeling that like, you know, our generation's kind of like, obviously the hobby's kind of booming a little bit now for us in Australia, but that next kind of generation or two, it's going to be such a surge, I think, where kind of maybe not get to like American standards or European standards, but it'll push pretty hard.
Oh, sure.
I think you think about all the social media that's out there now that's promoting all these animals as like awesome captives and, you know, an alternate animal to a cat or a dog or whatever it might be. It's going to change.
I think it's especially with like having unit blocks and stuff like that as well. Like you can't, most people can't have a dog anymore, you know, but they can have a 4-foot enclosure, you know, for a snake or a dragon or something, you know, like I think it's honestly, it's kind of helping the hobby, I reckon. Like the larger species, keeping them is going to, I think it'll probably slow down a bit for the larger species because you can't give like a big enclosure for your, you know, for like a lace monitor or any of your larger monitors, your olive pythons, all that sort of stuff. Whereas like the Antaresia is booming at the moment in Queensland. Like everyone with Antaresia is just going ham. Like the carp pythons are slowing down a little bit though. But like I get, like I don't have many Antaresia at all. And I've been getting heaps and heaps of messages asking for Stimson's pythons or spotted pythons or children's pythons. And it's like, oh, like, I don't have any. I'm sorry. Like, but these are some breeders to go to, you know, like, and even then, like, we're starting to struggle to kind of keep up with the demand with like the Antaresia and stuff. But then like with your black-headed pythons, like last year at last year's expo, there was heaps of black-headed pythons, heaps of womers. Whereas this year I had 3 black-headed pythons and that was the only black-headed pythons in the whole show. So it was a bit weird, like the different seasons changing, and but I think it just shows that the larger species are slowing down in demand, but the smaller species are just amping up. So
you as a keeper, I mean, obviously you love your carpets and your blackheads and things like that, but as kind of like, not that I want to call it a business, but let's face it, if you're rearing offspring, you're going to want to move them on to somebody. If nobody's buying bigger species, do you kind of think in your head like, oh, maybe I'll pivot the collection a little bit and maybe tailor towards smaller species, or are you still kind of just happy with the path that you're trending?
A little bit. I think it's more of going, okay, like say with the carpets, instead of pairing, say, 9 girls a season, I might only do like 4. You know, like, and just seeing how we go. Because, like, at the end of the day, I don't want to be stuck with, you know, 30, 40 hatchlings that I can't move on. And, like, I'd rather breed, like, I breed what I want. So if I have a project that I want to work with, I'll just do that. Like, at the moment, like, I've got 2 really good projects with carpets this season. And it's my Chimera Paradox girl that I produced a few years back. I'm putting her back over her dad, and she's 100% het, exanthic, 100% het albino, and her dad's a Moonglow. So I want to try to get more paradoxes out of them because she is just so cool. So that's probably my most keen pairing. And then I've got another one, which is a tiger-jag pair that I'm going to do, and I want to get, like, bright yellow with the darkest black striped all the way through their body. Like that's kind of the goal. Whereas like I've had heaps of people ask me, oh, can you do like normal albinos and that sort of stuff? I'm like, oh, I don't really. Like I'd rather just do what I want to breed myself, because then if I'm catering mainly to the public and just breeding whatever's the most popular, your collection will be changing every year. Like you'll have to do huge changes, because like last year, like the larger snakes were just booming. Whereas now it's kind of, it's really slowed down. But then again, like then you kind of see the demand. Like at the expo, I sold out all of my black-headed pythons really quick. So then the second day I brought some more. Didn't sell out on the second day though, but I had heaps of people saying, oh, you know, you're the only one with black-headed pythons. I was like, oh, that's a bit odd. Because last year we had exanthics, we had pinstripes, we had like the gold chins and all sorts, and there was just none. Just my stock standard black-headed pythons that I have, you know. But I think personally, I have started to get more of the smaller snakes. I'm not really too much of a fan of the smaller snakes. I should be because I'm only 5 foot two, but, you know, the bigger snakes are a bit more of my favorite thing. But I have bought a few Antaresia this year. So I've got 5 Antaresia now.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Something like that, 5. Just starting small, just because then I can offer the smaller species to people. And, I mean, having a few clutches of Antaresia, it's easier to house than a few clutches of carpets. You know, yeah. I can have the Antaresia, like, their whole lives and not have issues with space, whereas the carpets, like, I don't like keeping any of my adults in tubs. All my adults are in enclosures. So to do that with, like, you know, a suburban home for adult carpets, it's a bit hard. Yeah, so I like to kind of limit my numbers, work with the projects that I want to work with, and that's pretty much it. And now that I'm more diversifying, like I think it was yesterday, I picked up some geckos. So now I have geckos. Yes. So, yeah, I picked up some cynctus, some Nephrus cynctus. Nice. I was very, very excited about that.
That's a good pickup.
Yeah. When I saw the pair, I was like, done, sold, I'll take them.
So, do you think the morphs that have popped up in Antaresia also maybe have had something to do with the people leaning towards the smaller species of snake as well, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think now that we've got more combinations, and I think I find, like, being in, like, I've only been in the game for a few years. So, like, what I've noticed in trends is that a lot of, like, if you can have one species that has a whole different color palette, people like that. People can go and, you know, collect them almost. And I think we see that over in America, huge with, like, the ball pythons, the corn snakes, you know, all that sort of stuff. If you can see different morphs, then someone can own two snakes of the same species that look completely different, you know. And I think now with the Antaresia, like with the marble morph, there's so many variations of it now. You know, now we have like the patches, which or like the blizzards. We've got like the white marbles. They're probably my favorite, is the white marbles. Mm-hmm. You know, then you got like your dark, your really dark, like salt and pepper marbles. Then you've got, you know, like your real orange ones. Like there's such a variety in each morph now with the Antaresia that I think it's really just getting people along. And I think the fact that the like albino spider pythons are now lowering in price so more people can get into them, because like they're a wicked looking snake. Because a lot of people, like, you know, when you say you have pet snakes, everyone thinks you have an albino. They're always like, an albino is like the top tier kind of thing. So if you can have that in a small package, I think everyone's just going bananas over them at the moment. So hopefully I'll have a few this year. We'll see if my pair goes. But no, I think the morphs definitely help. I think that was the same with even like the olive pythons. Like once the albinos came out, I think that just caused a big boom. And same with the blackheads. Like you have a lot of people now collecting different variants of all different black-headed python morphs and working with polygenics as well into it. Like, you know, like with, you know, jungle carpet pythons, not like one jungle could be really gold and black, whereas another is like fluoro yellow and black, you know, and people can actually work with the different ones now. It's not like a stock standard. That's what that species looks like and only that. I think that definitely helps the hobby go far, and it helps educate people as well on a whole lot of different things. Like I'm right into genetics. So I love figuring out the genetics behind different morphs and figuring out how they work and how they affect the actual snake's DNA. That's why I like pairing all sorts of different morphs and seeing what comes out and all sorts. But like seeing like young kids learn about that now as well. And then I think it's actually helping them come into science a bit more now too.
Yeah,
I work with a lot of little kids and, it's just like everyone is starting to kind of get into a lot more scientific-y kind of things as well, and keeping naturalistically instead of just putting it in a tub with like paper towel or something like that.
Like, it's kind of crazy to hear some of the young kids kind of rattle off like percentages and different morphs and the, you know, what the percentages are going to be and this and that. And I mean, when I was that age, I was like, I didn't even know how to keep my crayon in the lines on a yep. drawing. Like, you know, it's crazy. It's good to see that.
Cool. It is. It's good to see people thinking differently and thinking outside the box. You know, like you get some kids that are like, oh, you know, like I want to get a children's python. Like, where do they live in the wild? And it's like, oh, like let me show you, you know, what you should set up that snake like. You know, don't just put like now. Like I've been talking to heaps of people about backgrounds and having backgrounds so the snakes can actually use the height. You know, if you're giving them like a 4 foot tall enclosure, but you're only putting one diagonal branch in there, they're not using that height properly. You know, whereas it's easy to make the backgrounds. It's time consuming, but it's not that hard. You know, like try a few times. Do you know? I use a tile pointing as well. I found that works so much better. And like you know, walking through people. This is how you do it, you know, and then seeing them figure it out for themselves. And then you can see, like, once they put that background in that enclosure and they can see their animals enjoying it,
yeah.
I think it just changes how they like to keep their animals. Like,
yeah, 100%.
It's the best feeling, you know.
Yeah, I think long gone are the days with, like, the one horizontal perch sort yep. of thing through a 4 foot box. You know, yep. that was kind of offered to your carpet python, or you know, maybe you put a melamine shelf in there or something like that, and that yep. was it, sort of thing. Yeah, like, I think we've all come from that at the end of the day, but you know,
exactly.
It's good to see the challenge, like the hobby kind of challenging itself, and because we've got that social media and we're all kind of communicating and seeing what other people are doing. It's you know, it's yep. triggering ideas in everyone's heads, and you know, just judging off the lace monitor enclosure behind you, like that thing just looks like yep. a work of art. In the garage there.
Yeah, thank you. It took a lot of work and that's all concrete. So
yeah, I can imagine that's concrete.
Yeah. And even then, they've destroyed some parts of it. Like where their nest box is, they've destroyed like a little corner. So now I can see the foam and I'm like, oh, I can't really fix it because otherwise I have to get them out. But it's most of the concrete is holding up pretty well. Whereas if I did tile pointing, they'd shred that like no tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like they'd climb up it once and it'd be gone, you know, no matter how many layers I put on it. And even like the concrete on most of the background, it's probably about like 3 inches thick. Like it's,
oh, wow.
I kind of went a little overboard. and yeah, like I think the whole enclosure weighs like 1.5 tons. Like,
oh,
yeah, it's insane.
Do you want to just kind of like maybe down the size of that enclosure, because it was pretty cool to see your Lacey just walking around trying to find somewhere to nest behind you yeah. or sleep down the night.
So it's 5 meters long, it is 1.5 deep and then 1.8 tall. So I can walk in there and do whatever, and then they yeah. come out in the reptile room and walk around, and I've actually harness trained them, so they come outside as well. So I put a harness on them and they can just run around out the front in the sun, get some natural sunlight as well. And then in the morning, like, I raise up the garage door so the sun comes right in the mornings and, like, you can see them basking in the direct sun through the window, which is pretty cool to see. That's cool. So it took a few months to make last year. I think, yeah, it'll be a year old in June, I think, June or July. So, yeah, it took months and months and months. And the planning for it was ridiculous. Like, I think I was planning for at least a month of working out how to do things. But no matter how much planning you do, when you actually start building it, it changes completely. Like, you're like, oh, yeah, this is what I want. And then, like, you start doing it, you're like, ah, oh, now I have to change it. Now this is what we're doing. Like, in the middle of the build, you know. Like, but I made everything from scratch. So all the frame, the ply I got. These are just sliding windows. So I've got two. Yeah. And they've got like the lock on it. So I find that with that lock, they can't actually open it at all. And yeah. it was cheaper. It was so much cheaper to do it that way than to do like big glass panels. Mm-hmm. And it's stronger as well, the glass. Whereas if I did like, it'd have to be like pool fencing panels, like glass yeah. panels. And that's heavy. So these was just so much easier. And then I just spray painted it all white to match the enclosure, which works pretty well. So
yeah, it looks unreal.
Yeah.
That's a great idea to use the windows.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think I saw someone in America do it in one of, like, the DIY enclosure pages on Facebook. And I was like, that is a brilliant idea. I think, like, for the both the windows, I think it cost me, like, $300 for both. And the windows pretty much span the entirety of the enclosure. So it's about four meters of windows. And I just, like, heaps of people that, you know, were doing renos and just, you know, had old window frames. I was like, I'll take them. So, which is quite easy, you know, easy to do. And my little trailer
You would have spent more money on glass. You can have just use glass. So.
Yeah, for sure. I think, like, having just the big glass panels probably would have looked nicer, like more of a seamless kind of look. But at the end of the day, like, I wanted to be strong. And the enclosure itself, I think, all up cost about $5,000 to make. So I was kind of trying to save as much money as I could by the end of it, because I was like, I've got to get the UVB lights, I've got to get all the heat lights, because I've got two basking spots, one on either end. And there's three lights on each basking spot. And then the UVB runs all the way, and some LED lights as well. And then, like, the substrate is about 30 centimeters deep the whole way, the whole enclosure. And then I've got a big nest box as well, which is like a termite mound. It looks like a termite mound.
Cool.
So I've made, like, a door so I can just open the top of it. I have to go digging, though, to find eggs if she does use it.
That's half fun, though, isn't it?
It is, especially when you're like, oh, the boy's going in there a lot. Oh, I wonder if he's eating the eggs. But with
have
the lasers.
Have you pictures that up on your Instagram?
I think I have some on my Facebook. I don't really use Instagram too much, but Facebook I should definitely have photos.
Yeah.
So and I can always flick through some. Yeah. Yeah, I think I documented, like, the whole build on Facebook. So, like, if you go back to, like, last year, you can see, like, when I did the frame. Well, so I got it's all on wheels. Not that it was a great idea to do that, but it is on wheels. So when I do, because we're only renting here, so when I do move, I can just get a tow truck to come up, and we can just slide it on a tow truck. Because I was like, I'm not like I wanted a big enclosure, and then I was almost going to do an aviary, but I've got big German shepherds in the backyard, and I was like, oh, I just don't know how they'd go. With the Lacys being in an aviary with them. And then I didn't want them out in the front yard or anything. So I was like, nah, okay, garage is the only thing to do. And then I went, well, I want it to look nice for me and I want it to be usable for the Lacys. So then I just went, all right, how long's the garage? Let's do a whole wall of the enclosure. So yeah, it was a big build. And, like, I live with Grandad, and Grandad was like, yeah, no, like, he's very much into – you got to go big for the enclosures, because otherwise if it's small, you know, the animal can't use the space. Whereas even now with the Lacys, like, when I move, they're going in a big aviary. Like, that's probably going to be at least, I'd say probably double the size of the garage, because I want to give them heaps of space. You know, they use it in the wild. They travel so far in their territories. Like, I want to give them as much space as I can. You know, I don't want to see them crammed up in a little enclosure where they can barely turn around and stuff like that. Just that's not how I like to see animals at all. You know, I want to see them in a nice enclosure. So,
no, you've definitely done them justice by far. It's an amazing enclosure. It's like I used to have a mangrove monitor, and she ended up getting to the stage where basically my life just changed. You know, there was no way that I could actually afford to give her any more space, so I had to make the hard call to go, no, I need to move you on because I'm not doing you justice. But like something like that with like a huge pond is kind of like what I imagined for like a pair of mangroves or something in there. That looks fantastic.
Well, I think once the Lacys move out of this, I'm going to put an olive in it, either an olive or a scrub.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, so that'd then really she'll cool. have buckets of room to move around, and because the ledges, like, they're solid, so, you know, the weight of like the adult boy Lace up there, he can easily sit on the ledge with the girl, and it's not, you know, I'm not worried about it, because I used like L brackets and then screwed plywood shelves right in into the actual frame of the enclosure, not just the ply, on the frame itself. So then it was all super sturdy and stuff, because like I didn't think I was gonna put that much concrete in it. But I'm glad I did it the way I did it, because otherwise if I didn't reinforce the shelves the way I did, it would have probably collapsed just by the weight of the concrete alone. Yeah, Bunnings knew me very well by the end of this build. Like, I'd be there every few days. So,
when you were going through it, did you kind of like estimate the amount of concrete that you'd be using and get like a delivery of like, I don't know, 40 bags to your home? Or did you kind of just go down every day and pick up a few new bags for a new section?
I was like, oh, 20 bags will do, I reckon. I think 20 bags will do. And so went to Bunnings, and lucky Bunnings is like right around the corner. So went to Bunnings, filled up the tray on my ute, and then I was like, oh yeah, I think that'll do. My poor ute's like that on an angle because of all the weight in the back. And then got it home, and yeah, the 20 bags did like a quarter of the enclosure. And I was like, oh, well, we need a lot more. So then the cost of the build and stuff just like doubled almost because of how much the concrete was. And we almost were going to get like a cement truck to come in, and like they do the, I can't remember what it's called, but they do like the concrete on the walls and they make it all.
Oh, like the kind of shock coating, I think it's
called. Yeah. So we were going to do that. I was looking at going, oh, you know, that'd be easy if we can just get, because the whole garage was empty at the time. So we could just get, you know, a truck to reverse back up and we just, you know, blast concrete all over the back, and we were almost going to do that, and then we're like, oh, the amount of like excess concrete that'd be all over the floor would just be too much, and I think the cost to get someone out was just too much, and I was like, you know, I'll do it all by hand. So I got me, my partner, and a friend to come over, and we just we smashed out the concrete probably in about 2 weeks, all the concrete. So
wow.
That's a big job.
It was a lot harder than we originally thought. I don't think I'll ever do if I do another big build like this, like, I probably won't go as thick with the concrete. I don't think it was needed. But at the time, like, we just didn't know, and I didn't want to make it and then the Lacys destroy it and go, oh, well, we should have added two more inches of concrete, you know. So I was like, oh, we'll just go really thick and just see how we go. But it's doing really well. Like, it's holding up onto their nails. Like, they climb all over the background, you know, like they'll jump from the background down to the floor. Like, they use every little bit of the space now. And it's so good to see, you know, you see like the female running around and hanging on the side, you know, like that, like they do in the wild, you know. And I've got some vertical branches in there as well that they can just climb up. And when I feed them, I try to get them up on the perches, you know, and get them using as much energy as possible. But no, I think that's the best way to keep them. I think if you want a lace monitor, don't just get like a small like 2 meter enclosure. Like, that's not how you should be keeping the lace. Like, they need more room. They're big lizards, especially the boys. Like, the size difference between the girl and the boy is ridiculous. Like, she's like half the size but double his age. So like but no, both of mine are sweethearts.
So as you got those guys, you got the freckled monitors. Do you have an Aki or something as well?
Yeah, I've got a pair of Akis. They're my partner's. They were his first reptile because he didn't know anything about reptiles until he met me. And then I kind of went, well, look, the reptiles come with me. So, and once he moved in, he kind of was like, all right, well, I really want my own little lizard. And he wanted a bearded dragon at the start. And I was like, nah. Look at these instead. Like, so then I showed him all sorts of different, all the smaller monitors. I was like, yeah, but the Akis are probably the best one for you because he wants to baby something, you know. And
yeah,
I had a mate that had a female, an adult female Aki who was super calm and everything. And I was like, hey, like, I know you wanted to sell her a while back. Do you still have her? And like, I'll take her. So, and he actually, I got my female lace off of him. So, yeah, so then got this female red Aki, and she's like, she is my partner's baby. Like, he pampers her so much, and he's they've got a 6 foot enclosure now, and then because she's a sandfire red Aki, so I was trying to track down a male that was as dark as she is, so finally found one, and then we had two clutches of eggs from them last year, so that was really cool to see the little babies. Then we got nine baby Akis all up.
Nice.
So, and that was so, like, he was so excited, you know, like, your first clutch of whatever it is, your first clutch is just such a big thing. You know, it's a big accomplishment to be able to, you know, say that you primed your animals for breeding, you cycled them properly, you got the eggs, you incubated the eggs, and then you got your babies out, and your babies are thriving. Like, it is the best feeling in the world, I reckon. So, you know, all the babies are gone now.
What was the first reptile that you bred?
Carpet pythons. Yeah, they were the first ones. My first season actually was a terrible, terrible season. I got one of those little like ExoTerra incubators.
Yes.
And they worked. I did testing for about 6 months prior to getting eggs. I had a thermostat in there, like a thermometer in there that was measuring all the temperatures. I was watching the incubator. Everything was fine. It was working beautifully. It was keeping the temperature proper. It wasn't fluctuating too much. It was doing really well. And then I paired up my carpets. I had a zebra jag and a zebra, paired them together. And actually my male turned out to be the female, and my female was the male. So the one that was a boy, I went and moved it out of the enclosure that it was in, moved into a different enclosure, because the female that was a boy, that was actually a boy, I paired that one to another female just to see what would happen, to see if he was a boy. And then sure enough, he instantly went and started mating with this other female. And I was like, okay, well, you're a boy. And so then I thought I got sold two boys.
Mm.
Like a month and a bit later, I'm like, oh, that male is getting really thick and I haven't fed him in a while. That's kind of weird. And I was like, oh, nah, it's fine. Yeah, like a few weeks later, I come in and there's eggs in there. And I was like, oh, you're a girl. Cool. So
got
the eggs. Yeah, exactly. So got the eggs, put them in the incubator, and like sitting there every day looking through the little door, you know, looking at the eggs, making sure everything was right. And then because I work full time as well, and I think at the time I was doing uni, and I was at uni, I think I was at uni all day. I came home and you hear the incubator beeping. And I was like, oh, what's that? The incubator was at 41 degrees. And I was like, oh, no. And it was like halfway through incubation. I was like, oh, crap. So then I went to, you know, saw what was going wrong with it. And it just looked like it set it to the highest temperature it could go to. So I was like, oh, you know, I don't know how long these eggs have been sitting at 41 degrees for. But it was at least a few hours. And then when they hatched, all of the babies except for one were so badly deformed. I nearly just quit breeding then. I was almost just like, no, that's it. I'm done. You know, like having to – and like all the deformed babies, they were all alive. So I had to euthanize all of them. And it just killed me. You know, to see your first little babies, I was just so upset. And then my mentors at the time, they were just like, no, like, you know, this thing happens, you know, and a lot of the time it is your first clutch that it happens at, you know, like there's always going to be mistakes. There's always going to be things that happen. So just, you know, you're going to take it with a grain of salt, learn from it, figure out what was wrong and try not to make that same mistake next year. So I was like, oh, you know, I really don't want to breed again and all this. But then I had one little survivor. And that little survivor, she was such a great, easy snake to get feeding. You know, she was so good to take care of. And so I ended up giving her to a friend, And now my cousin owns her, actually. So she kind of kept me going a little bit. I was like, oh, you know, maybe I'll give it another shot. So gave her another crack. I used that same incubator because I thought my little sisters had touched the buttons to make it go really high. No, it didn't. It was the incubator itself. It just skizzed out because it's all automatic. Like, you just touch the buttons. It's not like a thermostat where you can actually, like, see that that's the problem, not just the whole incubator. So we went, and second year round, the incubator does the same kind of thing in about halfway. Lucky I was home at the time, and it made it go cool, not hot, so it went the opposite way. So it made the temperature go really low, which isn't as bad for the eggs. Like, if it's hot, then, you know, your eggs are stuffed. But if it's cooler, they can withstand a little bit more. So then I end up having to get heat cord, putting it around a plastic tub and putting the eggs in there and put like a towel over it, because I only had like 3 weeks left before the babies were meant to hatch. So I was like, oh, I'll just see if this works. And it worked a treat. All the babies were healthy as. They were huge babies. So it was like, all right, cool. Like, now I've got it. And then I made an incubator myself out of a wine fridge. I was like, nah,
yeah.
I'm going to do my own one now. So, and that, like, I've got a Evo thermostat on that. I've got the heaps of different thermometers in it. So then if it gets out of a certain temperature range, it'll send a notification straight to my phone. Because I'm a bit wary of it now. I'm like, no, nah, it has to like send me a notification or something. And like every day, multiple times a day, I check the temperatures, make sure everything's good, make sure the little fans are circulating in the air. Like, I'm really like anal about the incubator now. And then like with my partner's clutch of Ackies, because there's such a long incubation time compared to the snakes, he was sitting there. And like I said to him, I was like, oh, have you checked your Ackies? And he goes, oh, no, I haven't for like a week. And I was like, you better get out there and check those eggs. Like, you got to do it every day. Like, and now he's like, oh, okay. But it's a learning thing. You know,
yeah.
You don't know everything straight off the bat. No matter how many times you hear it from different people, you know, like learning from experience is just, it's probably the best way, I think.
Definitely
take on board from heaps of people as well. And I think my thing was, don't, especially with the green tree pythons, right, breeding green tree pythons, there's so many ways of doing it. There's so many different ways of people saying, oh, this is the way, or this is the way, this is the way. And you just kind of listen to everything and go, okay, I'm gonna try different things and see what happens. Like, for instance, I keep my green tree pythons in bioactive enclosures. And a lot of the green tree python community doesn't like that. But at the same point, my bioactive enclosures are big. They're not just little, you know, little cubes, you know, like they're like, I've got a three greens in the, at the moment, in a 2 meter long by 1.5 deep by 1.8 tall enclosure at the moment. And oh, they are loving it. Like, they're showing, like, the adult females are showing behaviors that you see photographed in the wild, like the staying up tall at this, like during the day, and then coming down at night and looking like right above the ground, you know, doing like that, like, classic S strike position right above the ground, you know. And like one of the females, Flair, she goes right near the opening of the door. So all I have to do is slide that door a little bit and she's right there, you know, ready to go. I think she's figured out that that's like, that's the main door I opened to feed. And she's like, that's her hunting's position now.
That's the game trail. That's where the mice come in.
Yep.
That's
exactly.
It.
So it's so cool to see their behaviors differently to, you know, to when people keep them in tubs or just small enclosures. Like the difference in behavior is just so, so broad.
I was sitting down last night at one of my enclosures because I've got some juveniles that I've been growing up from the first clutch that I bred. And I watched one just kind of like, they're only 60 centimeter tall enclosures, but even still, like, this little tiny snake came off the top of the branch where it's kind of been hot, hanging off the little dripping rod right at the roof.
Yep.
Sits right in the bottom corner and just has its head like through the leaves, just like waiting for something to come past. And anywhere else in the green tree python community, they'd be like, something's wrong with your snake, it's broken. And I love revving those people up about that sort of stuff too. Like, oh no, it's on the ground. Oh no. But yeah, no, it's completely normal. Does it all the time too.
Yep. I've got one, he likes to do that. He used to like, when he was young, he used to be able to like perch on the palm fronts of the like little parlor palm. But as he's gotten bigger, he's a year old now, he can't anymore because he breaks the palm fronts. So instead, he kind of sits in the middle of them now. And I was like, oh, yeah, and that's him. And when he basks, he goes up and basks. You know, he does what he wants to do. Every night, he goes up on his spot, and that's just what he does. And there's, you know, like at the start I was like, oh, maybe it was humidity, you know, but then I realized, oh, he just liked to sit there when he was younger and he could sit on those palm fronds. So he's just changed now as he's got older because the palm fronds can't support his weight. Whereas in the big enclosure that I've got for the adults, I've got like big palms, like golden cane palms and stuff in there, and they can hold the weight of some of the young males, like of one of my young boys. And like he'll just sit there, like he'll sit in the S position with his head on the palm tree, and it's just it's so cool to see, you know, all the how they interact with their environment compared to, you know, keeping them in tubs and stuff. So,
100%. That was one of the biggest things for me. I was like, this is a, like, I kind of read all the books, right, when I had the Grand Tree Pythons, and I read them for years because I made plenty of mistakes before I even got a clutch.
Yeah.
And by the time I got the clutch, I looked at all these books and I was just like, bugger, I'm throwing them out the window.
Yep.
She's sitting on these eggs and she's wrapped up on these eggs.
Yep.
She'll do better than I do. I was like, yeah, let's just try that. And gave it a crack and it worked. This year she completely bombed out and she dropped 10 eggs from the perch and she just left them alone. And I candled them. There were veins and I was like, she just knew something was wrong with them. And like over the course of 2 weeks, they all just desiccated. But
it's
like, okay, I'll try again next year. You know, you just got to keep going.
My clutch that I got from Flair, she had 28 eggs.
Holy
moly. Yep. And at the – so – last year, I broke both my arms in September. I had motorbikes, and I was being a bit silly on my motorbike. And, I broke both my arms. My whole elbow needed my left elbow needed reconstructing, and I'm left-handed, so that kind of put a bit of an issue into feeding the animals and stuff. And then, so I had dual casts on, couldn't really do much. And then, of course, literally the night after I broke my arms, she laid the eggs. I was like, are you kidding? And I was like sitting there, like my first clutch of greens, like, oh, I was just so, like, I was a bit of a wreck. It was like the worst timing, you know, like she could have at least waited like a week for me to settle into my arms, you know, my cast on my arms or something, but no, that night. So I ended up getting my partner, like, I was sitting there with like both my arms and slings, like looking at him, like, you better not roll those eggs. Like, if you like roll those eggs, I'm going to be so mad at you. Like, and, we end up getting them out and putting them in the incubator. Again, it must be every single time I breed something for the first time, something goes wrong. And I don't know why something went wrong, but pretty much all of them, again, were deformed, but they all had head deformities. So I had some that had like really big overbites that didn't make it. I had some that have one eye, some that had no eyes. Like I had a whole variety of things. And out of the 28, all of them were developed except for, I think, four that weren't developed. And then I only had five survivors. So I've got I'm keeping two, maybe three, because one of them, I've nicknamed him Righty because he only has his right eye. He's eating, he's doing everything fine, but I think he's got a neurological issue because he kind of stardazes a little bit. And I think the eye that he does have, I think he's blind in it because his pupils don't
dilate,
that's the word. They don't dilate at all when this like light hits them. So I think he is blind in that eye as well, and he just relies off heat and smell. But he's eating well and everything, so I'm like, okay, I'll just leave you, see what happens. And then I've got another one called Lefty. He was always going to be my keeper. He was the first out of the egg, and he's only got his left eye, and he is powering along. He is doing so well, and I've got him in a little bioactive enclosure now as well. And just seeing him, like, he transitioned so well from the little tub to the enclosure, no issues. He ate, like, that night after I transitioned him over. And I was like, cool, righto. Like, so I think next time I raise up babies, I think I'm actually going to do them straight away in bio, straight from the eggs. So you're going to go straight into a bio enclosure. And when I say bio, like, I still do give it a bit of a clean, like especially with the adults. Like the bio waste that they produce is ridiculous. Like the cleanup crew can't do all of it. So I still take, you know, big chunks of poo out so then the bio load isn't as big. But with the big enclosure that I've got, that one I don't have to do it as much because the amount of isopods and springtails in that enclosure, they just like eat away all the poo really quick. So I'm like, all right, cool. And the sheds, both my big girl shed within like a few days of each other, and all the shed's gone now because of all the ice falls and stuff. They've all just eaten it all away. So I was like, oh, cool.
Remember, have you got frogs in with your green tree pythons?
I did.
Or did you have – yeah, you did.
Okay. I did. Yep. One of my girls, Flair, she loves her food. And I was like, oh, these frogs are a bit small. They might work. Yeah, no. I haven't seen them for like 3 months or heard them. So I'm like, yeah, I think she ate them. But one of my other greens, one of my young greens, Prince, he's in a 60 wide by 60 tall by 45. He has some Latoria phallax, the dwarf tree frogs. He has 7 in his enclosure. And he's been in there with them since he was yellow. And does fine. There's one particular little frog, and it's always the same one. He likes to sit on him, on Prince, on the green. So he'll just sit on the green, and they just chill like that. So, and like I thought the movement of when the frogs will be eating would trigger off his food response, but it kind of does, but he kind of sits there and goes, oh, no, that's okay. So they do pretty well together, those little guys. And now that he's bigger, like – the phallax are too small. They wouldn't even see him as food, you know. And that's why I think the phallax would do well with the adult greens, especially in, like, a big enclosure. I think the phallax would do really well because then, like, they're smaller than a pinky rat. Like, the adult greens, and my adult greens are huge. Like, my girls are big greens. Like, I think Spectra is probably the same size as my big carpet girls. Like, she's a big green. And she, I think any sort of green tree frog or white lip tree frog would be too much of similar size of prey. Whereas like the phallax, they're little tic tacs, you know, like she's not going to worry about them. Yeah, exactly. Whereas the young males, maybe they might have a crack. But Prince is a young boy and he's fine. He loves this little frog. It's like that little frog buddy just sits on him and even when he's eating, like. When I go to feed, I try to make sure none of the frogs are out, and I'll feed different times. So I'll try to feed the frogs, like, early morning once Prince has gone to bed, just to avoid any sort of issues. But, you know, there's one time that, you know, I put some crickets in late evening, and then Prince came out, and he's like, oh, I'm hungry. I was like, oh, okay, I'll give you a feed as well. And he was fine. Like, the frogs were on the same branch as him. Like, the frogs were hunting the crickets, and he was eating his, and he didn't care. He didn't drop it when he saw the movement or anything. He knew that was his, and he just doesn't see the frogs as prey. But that doesn't mean that all greens are going to do that, you know? Like, I think he could just be an exception. Like, he's just fine with them. But he's always been a laid-back green, so that's why I thought I'd give it a shot. And it worked so far, so.
Huh. Yeah, I haven't personally heard of anybody doing it, in captivity, that's like not a zoological institute or something like that. Yeah.
Yep.
And even when I saw it at a zoo, I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
I don't know how I don't think I'd be able to do that myself.
I think, you know? I did heaps of research before I even did it because I was like, I don't want to like sacrifice these frogs, you know, I wanted to make sure. And I found a lot of them were magnificent tree frogs. Not green tree frogs. Like, a lot of the zoos had mags. And then the greens were often males and smaller.
Right.
They weren't big adult females. And even then, like, I was going through, like, zoo chat, you know, like the zoo forums and stuff, going through some of them. And some of the keepers were saying that when breeding season comes for the female green tree pythons, they would take the frogs out because of how amped up her food responses and her food drivers at that point, and then once it slowed back down, then they would put the frogs back in. But again, it was the size as well. So, like, the magnificent tree frogs, you know, they're big frogs. And, you know, if the greens that were with them, that mag would have been a huge meal for it, you know. And the same thing is that you don't want to put, like, an adult green tree frog or an adult mag with a neo green tree python because the frog will eat the snake. You know, and that's the thing. Like, a lot of people don't realize that the frogs will also have a crack at the snakes. So you got to watch with the sizes. And if they're going to, like, what I do is, like, okay, that animal would be eating this kind of size prey, make sure that the frog isn't that size prey, and then you'll be right. You know, and like I've got some, the freckle monitor is in with a blue tongue and a shingleback, and they're fine.
All right.
So he's always up the top in his log, and the shingleback and the blue are just down the bottom, and they just do their thing. And it's so funny seeing like the skinks climb, because they'll climb up like where one of the basking spots is. Like they'll actually fully climb up to him and echo the freckle monitor. He just goes, "Oh, okay, whatever." Yeah. And yeah, they cohab really well. But again, it's knowing your animals, right? Like we've got the pair of Ackies together, and at the moment, all the female wants to do is just eat and eat and eat. So she started to smash the boy a little because the boy's smaller. He started to nip his tail a bit, so now we have to separate them. But last year they were fine together. But now she just wants more food. So it's like, you know, you got to know your animals, and sometimes it might be working for a year or two, and then something happens. You know, you just got to be on the ball with it. It makes it hard, though, you know, like with when I had some Roth's tree frogs in with the Grand Tree Pythons, the adults, and like I thought they were the perfect size. You know, they were a bit on the small side, so I didn't think the greens would think they were food. But unless they're still really quiet and hiding in there, because there is a possibility that they could just be hiding, because like it's a pretty big enclosure and they're pretty small frogs. But you never know, and that's why I'm like, oh, I haven't heard them, I haven't seen them. I do chuck crickets in there every now and then just in case, but yeah, I don't know. I'm like, oh.
Not gonna hold out hope.
No, but at the same time, like I think it's the female greens. I think trying to cohab frogs with female greens is just not gonna work. Their food drive is so strong compared to the boys. Like the boys will go off food for half the year, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas your girls, they will try to eat anything that moves. At least my two do. My two girls do. They'll just smash anything. So it's like.
Oh, yeah. All I got to do is walk into that room where my female is, and all of a sudden the head comes off the perch and she's right at the glass, just like, "Hey, today the day." Sort of thing.
Yep. So, they love their food, the greens. Like, is yours friendly? Like, can you handle yours?
Yeah, I can handle both of mine, but the female is very, for lack of a better term, cage defensive. You know, her cage is her cage. I'll have to hook her out to be able to handle her. But once she's on the hook, she's fine.
Yep.
Same as the little guys. The little guys can be a little bit touchy inside their cage.
Yes.
But, you know, it just comes down to that food drive and how much you're actually working with an animal. I mean, most people aren't typically handling greens over the top. So, you know, I don't really handle my snacks a hell of a lot, to be honest.
Yep. I don't really handle too many of my greens. I don't really, like, I'll get the girls out for photos and stuff. Now in this enclosure, I don't even have to, because when I take a photo of it, it's enclosure. Like, I've had some people think that the photo was in the wild. I'm like, no, it's actually an enclosure, you know? Like,
that's awesome.
So, yeah, that was really cool. But, no, both my girls are pretty friendly. I just go in, I give them a touch with the hook so they know it's not feeding time, and then I can grab them out. Same with all the boys. But at the moment, all the boys are so jittery now because of breeding season. All their hormones are going, and it's like, oh.
Yeah.
I was swapping males out the other day, and my little boy, Cyrus, who he was the father of last year's clutch, he's small. He's like maybe 300 grams, whereas the girls are like 1.2 kilos, 1.5 kilos. Like, so he's tiny. Breeds like no tomorrow, though. He's probably my best breeder. Even out of all my carpet pythons, he's like my best breeder. but getting him out, I was more worried he was going to nail me than the females. I was like, oh, he's so jittery at the moment. He's so on edge because he's been with two big girls, like, and he's been mating like every day for the last week. And I was like, oh, I've got to give the guy a break. Like, so yeah, separated him out, put an older male in there who doesn't seem to know what he's doing. But no, that male's pretty calm. I was like, oh, here, you go away. And then, yeah, Cyrus is in his enclosure, and he's still so jittery. Like, whenever I move, he's like, oh, what are you doing? Like, but it's not a food response. Like, it's a bit different. Like, when you know your behavior of your animals, it's kind of, you can kind of tell what they want. So, you know, he's a bit of a weird one. But,
Well, so something else we obviously wanted to touch on, and I think would be pretty good point in time to touch on it now, was the fact that you actually ran the Brisbane Reptile Expo for the last 2 years, if I'm not mistaken?
Yep, last 2 years, yeah.
How did you decide to get that up and off the ground?
Yeah, that's a pretty good feat in itself.
Yeah, it pretty much was, like, we haven't had an expo, like, before I ran my two. We hadn't had an expo up here for a few years. I think 2018 was the last Reptile Expo in Brisbane. Yeah. And that was pretty much, like, when I was getting into the reptiles. I had a few, and I was so excited to go to, I think it was RepX. And I was so excited to go to it. But then I got rostered on that weekend, and I was like, oh, I'll just go next year. And next year's expo never came. And then the following year there was not one, and another year there was none, and I was just getting so annoyed that there wasn't any reptile expos in Queensland. And I was just like, one day I came home from work and I was just ranting to my granddad about it. I was like, oh, you know, like, why isn't there an expo in Queensland? You know, there needs to be. Queensland's a big place. We have a big reptile hobby. Like, why can't we have an expo up here? And he just said to me, goes, why don't you run one? I was like, I can't run one. What do you mean? Like, surely you have to, you know, have some special license, and, you know, you can't just be someone with ambition, you know. And at the time, there was a license change for Queensland. So in 2020, we had a big license overhaul. So then everything, all the different licenses changed. So there was different categories now. What we can keep is different as well. And the laws behind the license is different, the legislation. So I had to look into the license change, see if we could actually run an expo, because all the previous years for the expo that they had, like 2018 and earlier, they had to actually they couldn't sell their animals at the expo. Yeah. They could bring their animals, show them, give out all their details, but they couldn't actually sell them right then and there at the expo. Until they managed to figure out that if they had a society's, like a society incorporation or whatever, they had a license for the society, then all the other vendors had to transfer all their animals onto the society's license to sell at the expo. And that was like a whole thing, you know, like once you're transferring animals over, it's just a big mess.
Nightmare. Yeah.
So then I don't know why they stopped running the expos. I'm not too sure. And then, yeah, once Granddad said that to me, late 2022, I was like, oh, I'll give it a shot. See what I can do. And then, yeah, months of back and forth with the government, because I think we all know how the government can be sometimes. Trying to find out the answer of what I have to do to run an expo, that people can sell their own animals at the expo. And after going from one department to the next, you know, like just ping-ponging all around, finally they transferred me to the senior wildlife officer of Brisbane. And I was able to talk to him, see what I had to do to actually organize the expo and everything like that. And yeah, and then I just had a few months so I had to prepare, get a society up and running, find a venue then. Because once all the paperwork was out of the way, then I actually had to deal with the venue and finding, you know, a big enough venue. I had no idea about the numbers to expect because we hadn't had an expo for years at that point. So I had no idea what to expect. We didn't know. Like back then, I'm like, oh, you know, the venue itself was like 10 grand. And I was like, holy moly, that's a lot of money. Like, I don't have a lot of money. I was like, how can I do this? And being that, like, I've never run an expo before, I've never done any sort of event planning. Like, I teach karate. That's kind of my biggest thing that, like, of managing people. You know, I have a class of like 20 students. That's pretty much all I do with, like, people, you know. So then I was trying to work out everything. My granddad was a big help in that. Like, he kind of helped, and then some of the other presidents of different societies in Australia helped me as well. So Joanne Payne helped me heaps. I was always like asking her questions, you know, oh, how about this, what did you do with this, you know. And she helped me out heaps to be able to get the expo up and running, and then found a venue, ran the expo last year. It was huge. Like, we had so many more people than what we thought. And like it ran pretty rough, not gonna lie. The first time, because like the size of the building was only 1,000 square meters, and we had about 30 different vendors there. And the lineup in the morning on this, because we did 2 days, so we do Saturday and Sunday. So on the Saturday morning, the lineup was like a few hundred meters long, like it was ridiculous. Whoa. And, we opened the doors and it was just a flood of people come through, you know. It got that packed in the building that you could barely move. So then we had to shut the doors. We couldn't take any more people in because it was just a safety hazard at that point. So then that caused, you know, a lot of upset people, because then they had to wait till it kind of the crowd thinned out a little bit. And then on the Sunday – we changed things on the Saturday night, so we actually added another, because it's a basketball court system, so we only had one court, so we added another court on the second day, which is a huge job to do, you know, move things over, and so we end up moving the demonstration show over into that court itself, because that was what was causing a whole big hold up with the crowd, was the demonstration show. So we moved them onto a whole new court, and then everything ran so much smoother, like it was just such a much of a better day. But it definitely gave me a lot to learn about, you know, a lot to think about. And I'm always open to suggestions. You know, if someone thinks they have a bit of an idea of something that could improve the expo, I'm always all ears. And last year I had a lady come up to me, and say, "Hey, would you, be willing to think about doing like a special needs disabled time so that people with disabilities can come in with a small crowd?" So, you know, people that that have mobility issues or sensory issues, they can freely move around in the expo and enjoy a reptile expo. And I thought that's a brilliant idea. So this year, that's what we did. We had an hour session at the start, and we roped the VIPs into that as well. And the crowd was only a maximum of 200 people. And we had a lot of people that came through with, you know, guide dogs, with wheelchairs, you know, people that had sensory issues. They could come around, they could look, they can talk to the breeders, and they can just enjoy a reptile expo without being in the massive crowds. And I that was like the best suggestion. You know, I was like, that's an amazing suggestion. Like the lady, Lucy, her name is, so I thanked her so much, you know, for helping me out. And it was a great suggestion, you know, so we'll be doing that for the years to come now. It's always going to be, you know, that first session. And because, you know, like, I'd feel terrible, you know, like, if I end up in a wheelchair and I couldn't go to a reptile expo because it was too busy, you know, like, it would suck, you know. So, you know, having, giving that ability to those people, you know, and, like, I had heaps of people come up to me saying, "Oh, thank you so much for it," you know. It's like, "Oh, no, it's all good." Like, you know, if some one of you guys didn't come and ask me and talk to me about it, I wouldn't have known. Because, you know, like, I'm able-bodied, so I didn't think about it, you know. And then when someone said that, I was like, that is an amazing idea. And I implemented it. You know, I implemented a few different things this year. We ended up having food trucks this year out the front so people could have a bit more variety of food that they could get. And the layout I made, so that we found a different venue because we had some dramas with last year's venue, way bigger. So this venue is 4,000 square meters. So it's huge.
That's huge.
And then it's just behind it is a train station as well. So public transport is super easy. There's a direct path from the train station to the venue. There was plenty of parking, and it's kind of like tucked away off of a main street. So like it's easy to find, but you don't have like, you know, the main traffic going past. We had, I think it was 47 vendors this year off the top of my head, something like that. And that took up like 75 booths. So it was crazy compared to last year. And we didn't have to close the doors at all this year. So that was a huge positive. Like having people, like even at like max rush on Saturday morning, people could still freely move around, you know, and I made the gap in between the aisles a lot bigger so that people could easily move around, and it just worked so much better. And, like, as I say to people, like, I'm always learning. I'm always thinking of different things to improve the expo. And, like, next year is always going to be bigger and better. Like, I'm learning new things. I'm implementing new things. And it's always going to be trial and error, you know. Like,
exactly
once we
right.
find something that's great, you know, then we'll stick to it. But and then this year we had – because it was Easter weekend. So we kind of shot ourselves on the foot a little bit with being Easter weekend. Sunday was quiet because it was Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
But it was consistent. So we had a consistent amount of people the entire way through. Whereas Saturday was like a mad rush the first few hours of the morning, and then it died off in the afternoon, which was to be expected. You know, a lot of people like to spend dinner with their family on a Saturday and things. But, yeah, we had because it was Easter, we had like a little treasure hunt kind of thing. So they had to follow the clues. Well, I had like a little plant that followed them. I had to follow the clues, find the booths that matched the clues, and get a little stamp. And the kids loved it. They loved doing that. And then they got That's like a little – we did like a little goodie bag, and it had like reptile stickers. It had some reptile figurines in it, had some colouring in, reptile colouring ins, and some pencils and stuff. Like, they loved it. The kids loved it, you know. And we had Easter eggs for the kids, and, yeah, it worked so much better. It was a lot more stressful for me because it was a lot bigger, and then I had to actually do – I had to organise all the hiring of like everything, whereas last year the venue did it.
Right.
So it was a lot more work, but I think the work paid off in the end. So
it looks like a great expo. I think I watched that. I've forgotten his first name, but the guy that runs the
Winds
of Blood and Brendy. Yep, that's Brendy. It. Yeah, yep. I wanted to say Benji, but yeah, Brendy. Yeah, I watched his YouTube video of the expo, the whole one, and I was like, yeah, that's a really good looking expo. You know, like it looks like there's so many great breeders there with awesome setups and stuff, and. Yeah, it looked fantastic. I think one year I might even just have to hop on a plane and come up for the weekend or something like that to take a day
definitely.
To people or whatever up there because it looked like a good time.
Yeah, it was awesome. And, like, for Queensland, like, we didn't really have much where all of us breeders were in one room together talking, you know.
Yeah.
And, like, oh, I just love talking, you know, going in the morning, talking to everyone and, you know, seeing all the different breeders of, you know, what different people are working on. Because for expos, it's the only place that you can see multiple animals from that breeder. You know, a lot of breeders don't allow people to come to their house and have a look at like a whole, you know, bunch, a whole clutch or whatever. So to be able to see so many different animals, different genes, you know, from the same pairings and everything, it was so good to see, you know. And it was like I think a lot of friendships started with the expo. Like I knew a lot of people just from online, you know, like people I've been following for years, you know, and then to be able to meet them in person, like Joe Ball couldn't come this year, but he came last year. And I was like, oh my God, it's Joe Ball, you know, like I was like so excited. And he was excited to meet me, you know, and I was just like, oh, yeah, like I was just so nervous. I was like fangirling the whole time. Like, oh, it was such an issue. Like last year I was just like, oh, you know, like Mitch from Stank Sanctum, you know, like all these people I've been following for years. And I finally met them in person, you know, and like a lot of the breeders are like down to earth. They're great to talk to. They have so much knowledge as well. Like I love learning. I love taking new information. So listening to other breeders, seeing what they do and like their opinions on things, it's so refreshing to me. Like I just love to learn, you know, in different environments. So I think the expo gives a great opportunity for that. You know, and like the one thing we will be implementing, I was trying to implement it this year, but we just couldn't, we didn't have enough time, was having like different speakers talk on the day. So then we can have, you know, like a Peter Dragon talk and like, you know, an Antaresia talk, a carp python talk, a blue tongue talk, you know, things like that. So then people can actually learn a bit more instead of just doing one-on-one with the breeders. Although I find, like, you know, having one-on-one with the breeders is huge, you know. It helps you so much in how you keep, especially if you're buying from that breeder. You know, if you're buying from that breeder, it's best to see how they're keeping their animals, especially when it comes to, like, hatchling snakes. You know, like, you don't want to change something too much. Otherwise, you know, the snakes might go off food and things like that. But at the same point, one individual breeder can only talk to so many people. You know, whereas if we have them with a microphone and we have, you know, 20, 30, 40 plus people listening to them, all of those people can learn rather than just one or two, you know. So I think that's the next big thing we're going to implement into the expo. But it's just little steps, you know, because running an expo is a lot of work, and a lot of people don't like, they don't realize how much work goes into it. And like, I work full time as well. So like doing the expo and working full time plus all my animals, it's a lot, you know, it's a lot to do. But I'm stubborn, and once I have my mind set to something, that's what I'm doing. So,
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yes, exactly. You know, so as long as, if you know you're wrong, you know, like, but yeah, and that's why, like, I'm always eager to hear people's suggestions on things. And obviously some things, like, I can't change, you know, like I had someone last year, he got a bit upset because he wanted a specific type of, I think it was an Antaresia morph. That he wanted, and before we actually opened to the public, another breeder had gone around and bought that particular snake, and which, you know, it is unfair to the public, but I can't really enforce a rule of saying that no breeders can buy at the expo or before the public, because it's too hard to enforce. And at the end of the day, if you want something from a breeder, the best way to do it is contact that breeder prior to the expo. And a lot of the breeders will hold that animal for you. You know, if you want that morph, just say, hey, look, I want this morph. Can you put my name on it? I'll pick it up first thing Saturday morning. You know, like same as if you do it any other time, you know, when you're buying an animal. So I think, doing that will be the best option if you wanted a specific animal. But yeah, like certain things like that, it makes it hard. And I don't want to be controlling to the other breeders as well, because at the end of the day, it's a fun weekend for all of us, you know. We all get to hang out and talk and, you know, see different things, meet a lot of people. By the end of it, we're all exhausted. You know, like if you come on like the Sunday afternoon, like late in the afternoon just before we close, all of us are just so exhausted. You know, we're all sitting there like, oh, my God, like big days. And like a lot of the reptile people, a lot of us aren't really social either. So having a big day where you're meeting thousands of people, it's a lot for a lot of people, you know, it's a lot to deal with. So like after I have like a few days off to a week off after the expo, just to sort of chill out, relax, you know, write down the things that were good, write down the things that need improving on and all that sort of stuff. But for last year, we had quite a few complaints, mainly because of how crowded it was. This year, we only had, for what I've seen, I've only had two complaints. I think that is a major step forward.
Definitely.
From last year. So that shows me, okay, cool. The venue is a great venue. We're going to keep the venue. And they work really well with me as well. Like a lot of venues, a lot of them are really hard to deal with. Or like they book out really quick, or they're really expensive, or like there's some venues that want commission as well. So they want, like we had one venue, it was a great venue, plenty of parking, train station right there, it was perfect. But they wanted to take 17% of all the sales from everyone. And I was like, that is not happening whatsoever. like that is too much. You know, like if it was like, 1%, still it's like, but 17%, I was like, no. Thanks for your time. Like, I'll find somewhere else.
No one sold anything that day.
Exactly. Right.
Damn.
Yeah.
It was a bust.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. Oh, but no. So it took a while to find a venue. Because we were originally planning to do the same venue at Moray Field that we did last year, and then they pretty much said to us, they were like, "Oh, you can like we have a numbers cap now." The only like the highest amount that you can have at one time in the expo is 200 people. And I went, that's not even feasible, like at all. And then I thought that was just the public. That was including the vendors. And I was like, that's crazy. That's not even, I can't at all do that at all. Like, not even if I did sessions, nothing. So I was like, okay, well, now I have to find a new venue. I thought that was ridiculous, like 1,000 square meters. And then I was going to hire out the whole, because it's got, this venue had two sides. So I had three courts on one side, three courts on the other. I was going to hire out the entire building like six courts. I was going to hire out all of it. And no, they said 300 people. Yeah, it was 300 with vendors, 200 without, because it was about 100 vendors. So I was like, that's ridiculous. Like, I can't do that, like, at all. That'd be then thousands of people would be missing out at the expo.
Yeah.
So as much as that venue, like, that venue would do all, like, the carpet, tables, chairs, tablecloths, like, it did all of that for me. And it had aircon. It was great. So, but I just, like, so many people would miss out, you know, and I couldn't just do that to people. Same with the breeders, you know, if you're doing that much effort and time and money into setting up your own booths and I can only bring in this many people to potentially do sales from maybe one or two out of every 10, you know, like, it just wasn't feasible. So was finding a new venue. We'd looked at the convention centres and stuff here in Brisbane. But again, they just weren't feasible. They were way too much for the amount of floor space that we had. And a lot of them were paid parking as well. And I didn't really want paid parking. I wanted parking to be free for people because at the end of the day, they're paying for the ticket for the expo.
That's right,
you know, so I don't want to make them pay. Like, a family wouldn't be able to afford to go out to the expo if parking is also like $20, you know, like, it just wasn't, right. I felt bad having to make people pay for parking. So I was like, nah, we got to find somewhere with free parking. And we did. So this venue is fantastic. It's at Zilmere, so it's a little bit more central. It's not so far north of Brisbane. And, yeah, I think it was such a great venue. So it has, like, a huge grandstand that people can all sit up on and everything. We had like, one court just laid out just with tables and chairs so people could just sit down, have a break, think about purchases and stuff as well. Because the last thing I want is people making impulse purchases. I don't want people to just go and just, you know, go, oh, I like the color of that snake, I'm going to buy it, without thinking about anything. You know, I want people to sit down, have a think about it. Is that the animal right for you? Get a setup. And at the expo, you know, it allows you to buy a whole setup in the one place. You can see the snakes that you want, and you can see the setups you want, you know. So my good mates, Ethan from Hatched Reptile Supplies, he had a huge stall this year at the expo. I think it was like 20 meters long. Like, he took up like a whole wall. He does enclosures, and he does rodents, he does products, like, everything. So a lot of the breeders were sending them to him. You know, go buy a setup from him. You can get everything. You can get a background, you can get your light fittings, everything. You get a whole setup from him. And they breed reptiles now too. So they're kind of turning into a one-stop shop. But it was good to see, you know, different people had different options. You know, there was a few other enclosure guys there that did different things. You know, like, some of them have, you know, might be a white melamine enclosure, but they have black trim, you know, looks a bit different. Some had full blacked out enclosures, you know, that look really cool. Others had PVC enclosures. Habitats at Home do enclosures for Mitch from Snake Sanctum, and they were there, and I was so excited to talk to him because I was like, I have some projects I want you to do. Like, I want big, big PVC enclosures for the greens. Like, that's what I want, you know. And being able to talk to them in person is so much easier than messaging, you know, or calling. You know, it's a completely different vibe. And to be able to sit down and chat with people, you know, especially when it comes to enclosures, I find, because, you know, like, if you're researching, like, if you're a newbie, it's the first reptile that you're getting or whatever. You go, oh, a 4-foot enclosure. You can't really picture it in your head. You know, like, you might be able to measure it out or whatever, but you can't see the size. So then when you can see, okay, that animal needs this size enclosure, you know, and you can actually see how big that enclosure is and see where you want it in your house as well, you know. And, like, I've got a couple of mates now that I've been convincing to get bigger enclosures and, you know, put your carpet python in a 6-foot enclosure, you know, not just a 4-foot, you know. Like, do bigger for your animals. And now she's got, like, she's got this 4 or 5 foot wide but like 8 foot tall enclosure for one of her carpet pythons. She's doing like a full background and everything for it and stuff, and like, she was picking up heaps of things from the expo, you know, like there was creepy crawlies backgrounds and stuff. I think they're from New South Wales. They came up as well. and brought heaps of different backgrounds, and they do the tile pointing backgrounds.
Yep.
And they make hides and water bowls and all sorts of different things. And they did really well because there's not too many people doing that sort of stuff up here in Queensland that do ready-made ones for a set size. A lot of them are custom. Yep. But with everything custom, it's a bit more expensive, you know, because it's 100%, custom.
Yeah.
And like, we know how long it takes to do those backgrounds, you know, it's not, it doesn't just take 20 minutes, you know, like it takes a long time. So, and time is money, you know, so to be able to have some stock standard backgrounds and a more affordable price was just awesome for people. Cause then people can, I think it elevates people's keeping. If you can see your animal in a nice enclosure, you want to care for it better. Whereas if it's just in, you know, plain white enclosure with dirt and a hide and a water bowl, it's boring for the keeper to look at. And I think if the enclosure is boring, your keeping isn't as, you know, top notch. Obviously, you know, there's different ways people like to keep, but I think that's what happens. Like, I like to have my animals in big elaborate enclosures because then they enjoy it and I enjoy looking at them doing it. You know, whereas if they're just in tubs hiding away, like, I don't get any joy out of that. You know, like, I go, let me show you the snakes, you know, pulling out tubs. But it's just, I'd rather be like, look at this big olive python in this big enclosure, you know, that looks like its natural habitat. You know, like, I like that more. And even with the morphs, you know, just because it's a morph and it's not a wild type doesn't mean you can't put it in a wild type looking enclosure. You know, like, it's just... Yeah. And I think that the hobby is changing a lot now for that. And I'm really excited to see how the hobby goes with that sort of thing, with getting bigger enclosures and stuff. And for years, like, I've followed your YouTube channel for years now. Like, I've been watching videos and builds and all that sort of stuff. And when you were the one that actually showed me the tile pointing, and I was like, oh, amazing. Because, you know, I watch like Serpent Designs and stuff all the time over in America. And he has the dry lock. And I was like, how good would it be if we had something like that here, you know? And then I was trying to I was searching up DIY backgrounds for in Australia. And then you came up and then Coop's Reptiles came up. And I was like, oh, they're my go-to now, you know? And I was just watching and watching and watching. And I was like, oh, that tile pointing. Let me go see if I can get it from Bunnings. And then, I started playing around with tile pointing, and I was like, this stuff is so much better than anything. Like, I did the good old silicone on the foam and then put, dirt on it.
And that's horrible.
Is the messiest stuff. Oh, it's so bad. It's so bad. Like, for, a rainforest theme. Exactly. And if you don't carve out all the foam, then the silicone will fall off. And then if you, all the foam we get that's, you know, affordable is all white. So then you have to, if you're using clear silicone and some fall off, you can see the white shining through. Exactly. And it was like, oh, the amount of effort to make a background with the silicone method just sucked. So I was like, nah, let's trial tile pointing. It was so much easier. Like, I actually started doing tile pointing when both my arms were in casts. And, I carved out the foam and everything with my arms and cast and everything. I had just surgery on my elbow to reconstruct it. And I was,
sure you talked about that.
Oh, yeah. But, no, I find, because, you know, doctors, doctors tell you, oh, you can only, you know, don't use your arm, you know. Like, at the time, I could only flex it from here to, here. That was, the range of movement, about, 45-degree movement. And couldn't straighten it at all. Couldn't bend it all the way back at all, and it was a bit of a pain, and I was like, I need this enclosure set up for these netted dragons that are coming. I have to just do it. So I was sitting there with the foam, with my hot foam carver, carving out all the foam and stuff, made in the background. And I was like, oh, let's give it a shot with this tile pointing. And I used my legs to move the bucket of tile pointing over onto the foam, and then just got a paintbrush, started putting it on. And I was like, oh, this is cool, you know, and then it was a bit thick, so then I watered it down a little bit, and, how easy it is to learn to use a tile pointing, I think people just need to do it. They just, you know, just give it a shot, you know, and it's cheap for, you know, a bucket of tile pointing is $40, and it goes a long way, you know, so you have a few enclosures, you can use it for the heaps of enclosures. So I think it's the best way, and I think the more that people you know, educate other people that, you know, use tile pointing. This is how you do it. It's easy. It's like paint. You just carve out the foam, see what you like. And the first ones that you make is probably, you're probably not going to like it at the end, you know, like you have to learn a lot of how to make the foam look like rocks and then do the tile pointing over it, you know? But like now I think I'm pretty confident in how I use the tile pointing, and like this enclosure, the lace water enclosure with the concrete, that was a whole new kettle of fish. Because it works so differently compared. That was a nightmare. Concrete sucks. Don't do concrete, people. Like it's so hard to do. So all the concrete is out there. You hard job.
Yeah. I think the level of detail people can get with like the concrete backgrounds and stuff are next level.
Yes.
But for like the person that just wants to give like the first few backgrounds a go, or the person like myself who's incredibly lazy and just wants something easy to use that's an off the shelf product, tile pointing is my go to.
Yep.
It just the ease for me is the biggest thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
The concrete seems a bit more time consuming as well. Like you've got to put it on, wait for the semi dry before you can, you know, do a bit of carving and doing all that kind of stuff. So
I think with like the timing,
really good, I didn't pay them to do them.
Exactly. Right. That's what I should have done. Then not doing it myself. Cause like the amount of times I redid the back, like we went over, we pretty much finished it all. I stepped back, looked at it, and I hated it. Hated all of it. I was like, nah, that looks ugly. It doesn't look natural. Let's give it another shot. And I was like watching, there's a guy, I think he's in Malaysia. He does really big, like, ecosystem looking backyards and stuff, so he does like waterfalls and, you know, and he used a lot of the concrete to make these waterfalls, and I was watching how he was working with the concrete and I was like, oh, that's a good idea. And he was like layering out concrete so it looked like slate rocks on top of each other. I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. And then I was talking to I can't remember his name, but he's up here in Brisbane. He does big enclosures, he does concrete and stuff too. And he helped me out heaps too with, because I was originally going to do tile pointing and he was like, no, concrete. It's hard, but do concrete. So he helped me out, showed me how to do it. He sent me heaps of videos and photos and I just went, all right, cool, I'll give it a crack. So I used heaps of different people's techniques to try to make the rock wall look like a rock wall. And I didn't smooth the concrete or anything like that. Like I wanted it to be easier to grip on for the lizards as well and make it look that like that natural kind of rock look. And then the painting really made it come to life. So doing all the different shades, and we bought a big spray gun and I just had paint, just sprayed it with the spray gun and stuff and did so many different layers of paint to be able to get like the shading and, you know, the highlights and that sort of thing. So it took a lot longer. I did like two or three times the whole background. Added some more slate-looking things, concrete bits, and finally got it to where I'm happy with it. And like it, when I were to go do it again, I now have even easier techniques that I've learned since then. But it's always you learn these techniques after the project. You know, it always seems to happen. So,
but no, 100%. I don't think it ever stops learning. I think this hobby is one of those things that's good. It kind of keeps your brain active. You're constantly wanting to better something. You're constantly wanting to learn something new.
Yep.
No, it's a good hobby to be involved in, that's for sure.
It is. It's an exciting hobby. Like, you know, things are always changing. We always are finding out new things, you know. Going out into the actual bush to see where your species is from is, like, the best opportunity, you know, like – before I got the Laces, I was originally going to get Parentes. I was going to get a Parente. And I was actually able to go out in the field and help and volunteer for a research project to study Parentes. And it was probably like the best trip I've ever been on. Like, it was amazing. Like, to go out, like, for free, or I had just had to pay for flights. There was food, accommodation. Like, it was like a little donger, you know. And I just had to fly out to Uluru and to the Yalara airport, and then got picked up by the research crew, and we just went out like in the middle of nowhere on a cattle station, And every morning we go out and look for reptiles. Like, it was the best thing. It was like a whole month of herbing in the desert. Like, it was wicked. You know, the amount of, like, I think my my newfound interest in a lot of the skink species came from that trip. Like, I wasn't really a skink fan. And then when you see these little skinks running around and you're with people that are so excited that, oh, that little skink, what type of species is it? You know, like, and it was just, it was so exciting to just go out there with people that knew what, like, that knew what they were doing, you know. And we're sitting there with our field guides, you know, flicking through, seeing what species it is, taking photos, seeing, you know, oh, going back to base and going, oh, it kind of looks like this Tenotus, but it might be this Tenotus instead, you know, like, it was just such a cool experience. And we saw a lot of parentes, and we were tracking down these parentes. And we could see how far each parente would travel in like a day. And from that point on, I went, I am not keeping a parente until I can keep it in like a massive enclosure. And I'm talking like 20 meter long enclosure. And that's when, once I can do that, then I'll get a parente. But if I can't do that, I'm not getting a parente until then. Because the amount of distance that the males travel is ridiculous. Like, they'll go out from their rocky outcrops all the way out into the dunes and back in a day. And, like, we're sitting there following them. And I was exhausted, like, each trip that one male would do. I was like, nah, like, seeing how far they travel was just a whole big mind-blowing experience, you know. And like the females seeing their behavior different to the boys, you know, the females would stay closer to the rocky edges, but again, they were smaller, so, you know, big eagles coming around might not go for an adult male parente, but a small female adult, they might go for her, you know. So they would always go more closer to the rocks. And then just seeing the habitat that they lived in, you know, like, I took heaps of photos of the rocky outcrops so I could replicate it in the future. And I just go back every now and then, look at those photos and go, like, that trip was amazing. You know, like, the experience that I learned out there was nothing compared to talking to keepers about those species. You know, it's a whole new kettle of fish, you know. So
it's one of those things too, that when you do kind of experience that, then you wonder if you can ever do any captive animal justice. Yep. Like, it really kind of blows your mind to just the simple things. You're like, you know, but it's like a lizard this big, it's only 4 inches long or something, but it uses this massive range, but I'm keeping it in a 2 foot box or something like that, you know. Like, it's hard to kind of quantify it, nature versus captivity.
Yep. And I think quantifying like the happiness of a reptile based on if it's going to breed or not shouldn't be
the level.
Yeah, like, exactly.
That shouldn't be what we're basing it off of. You know, like, at the end of the day, reptiles, they are primitive. You know, they're a primitive family of animals, and they run on instincts. Their instincts is to procreate. They have to make babies. That is just their instinct. If that female, like, that male will mate with anything, most males, you know. So you get the odd few, and in the wild, their lines would die where they are. You know, it wouldn't continue. Whereas, like, we tend to breed a lot of animals that, you know, in the wild they wouldn't thrive, but we can keep them in captivity. So I think basing off, oh, well, you know, my green tree python loves its 2 foot cube with one PVC perch. It's breeding. It must be happy. Like, I think that is just, it shouldn't be the way that we see, that we judge if that animal is thriving in that environment. But we haven't figured out something better per se. So I think we will eventually. And I think as we study the reptiles more, and obviously it changes in different species too, you know, like with the monitors, you can see that they're happier in bigger enclosures, that they, you know, they have the space to move around. You know, even if you might only see that animal staying in that one spot, guarantee you they're not always in that one spot. You know, like, we get it with the green tree pythons heaps. Oh, it never moves. It just stays in the same spot. Have you ever looked at your snake at night? Ever? Like, I guarantee if that snake is only staying in the one spot, it's not happy with something in that enclosure. You know, like,
that's right.
You got to give them the opportunities.
That's not only that too, but it's also the keeper. You know, that keeper might see it X amount of hours a day or whatever and see that it's sitting in one spot and then go, this is the most boring animal ever, and then sell it on. But it doesn't. They don't actually sit there and watch the animal and see the behaviours that it has. Like the amount of people that have gone, why do you bother keeping greens? It just sits on a stick. And it's like, they don't at all. But that's if you pay attention and you give them the opportunities, like you say, they do heaps of stuff. Yeah.
They're such interesting species. That's it. It's just, I think, like, even your carl pythons, you know, your carl pythons will bask for most of the day. They're going to stay in the same spot, but, like, they'll start moving a bit earlier in the afternoon compared to, you know, your green tree pythons, you know. And, like in my, so in the lace monitor enclosure, in my green tree python enclosure, and in my room, I've got security cameras. And I get them to record, like for the green tree pythons, I get them to the record anytime something moves in the enclosure so I can see what they're doing. You know, I can monitor their patterns. I can go back in the morning because I'm not going to be sitting here watching them at 2 a.m. in the morning, you know. So I can just sit there on my phone, have a look, go through, oh, they were doing this. That's cool. Oh, I can see the males trying to mate with the female at this time. That's cool, you know. And same with the lazies, you know, like because I'm actually a manager at Hungry Jack's, so my shifts change to whatever, you know. I could be doing day shifts, night shifts, overnight shifts, all sorts. So I can't sit and watch my animals. So the cameras that I set up with, so the cameras turn on when the enclosure turns on, because at night time the lazies aren't moving. You know, when the lights are off, they're asleep. So I just have the camera on during the day, and if they move around, it just tracks them and it will video them if they're moving around or doing anything. And then I can see, oh, he was actually doing courtship behavior at this time. You know, like I can see all these different things. And I'm seeing a lot more keepers using cameras now as well so they can watch their animals, because you can't sit there and stare at them all the time. And you're not going to see a lot of their behaviors anyway if you're just sitting there and staring at them, you know. Whereas if you have a camera in there, I see so many different things. Like I see the boy, lace monitor, pissing off the girl all the time, just because, you know, like he'll just sit there and start annoying her. But then when I'm in here, all their attention is on me. So they'll come up and see what I'm doing, you know. And I don't see those little interactions, but with the cameras I can. And I think that just elevates my ability to keep them a bit more. So,
yeah, 100%. I do the same thing. I quite often would be at work and I'd log in and see things running around or doing whatever, and you just go, yeah, if I was in that room, that cryptic species would be hiding right now.
Yep, exactly. You know? And especially when you're keeping those things.
I can't come out today, you know?
Yep. I think with a lot of my guys, they're all so used to me now, like all my animals. So whenever I'm in the room, they're like, oh, it's either feed time or clean time, you know? What is it today, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, even my carpets, they'll come up, like, once they see me or hear me in the room, they're like, oh, what are you doing, you know? And the lazies, they're just always, like, the second I turn the lights on to get ready for tonight, they were like, oh, are you feeding us or something? Like, usually you don't turn the lights on at night, you know? And they were coming up and the boy was actually, like, right behind me, like, glass sliding on the door because he was just like, what are you doing? Like, they're just such interesting animals, you know? Like, oh, I love them so much. And same with the green tree monitors. Like, we were chopping down some trimming some trees the other day, and I got my partner to just put some in all the monitor enclosures. You know, just chuck a few branches in. They'll love it, you know? Of course, my lacy is trying to dig at the door, but as I start talking about him. No, and he put some branches in, and immediately the laces came over and were sniffing everything, you know, they were moving the branches, and it's just that enrichment, you know, like they love new things. They're very intelligent animals. And same with the green tree monitors. Like the male is a lot more bold than the female, and the female, she's, you know, a bit skittish, but they're very inquisitive. So the second that he put those branches in, he actually had to lift the male off of the branch because he was trying to reposition it, because the male was so curious as to what he was doing. He didn't even care that my partner was there, you know. And it's, like, it's interesting things like that, you know, where he's like, oh, like, now I was like, oh, I have to go and I want to see him do that, you know. Like, but no, it's just interesting, you know. Enrichment is great for your animals. And I think a lot of people are starting to understand that now in the hobby.
Yeah, I always find it good fun to go get a couple of cuttings or something like that and just chuck it in and just watch everything just come out and start sniffing, and they're just like, oh, something new today, thank you. You know, like it's, yeah, just that bit of stimulus goes a long way.
It does, yeah. It's crazy. So, but even like with the Lacies, I was cleaning an enclosure, a snake enclosure, and she had some shed there and stuff. I was like, oh, I'll grab the shed out, grab some of the dirt, and I'll just put it in the Lacie enclosure, see what they do, you know. And my girl, Daisy, her name is, she's a funny girl. She almost gets jealous when I'm holding something that's not her. If I'm giving anything attention that's not her, she has a bit of a hissy fit. It's so weird. Like, I don't want to, you know, put human emotions on a reptile, but the best way I can describe it is it looks like jealousy. Like, she's like, no, look at me instead. Why are you holding that thing, you know? And so I was like, oh, you know, I'll put a snake shed in some like dirt that a snake's been on. I'll put it in the enclosure, see what happens. And the male just started scenting all over it. Like, hey, is like, nah, this is going to smell like me now, you know. And the female was very wary of it. She hated the shed. She was like, she was standing and squaring up to the shed. And I was like, it's not a snake, it's all right, you know. And then she's such a weird lizard. Like, she's so personable for an animal, like for a reptile. And so I took the shed out because she was a bit grumpy. And then she calmed down immediately once the shed was gone. I was like, all right, cool, cool, cool. Whereas the male didn't care about the shed. He was just like, the smell, it's not, doesn't smell like his territory, so he's going to scent mark all over it. So I was like, oh, cool. Now you've just made more of a mess. But no, they're interesting animals.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, as we've said multiple times on this podcast, it's all changing now. And, you know, people are starting to see these sorts of interactions and just go, oh, yeah, let's just tweak it up. It's no longer just a snake in a box. It's, you know, it is a living being that does need that stimulus and that bit of enrichment. Yeah.
That's it.
100%. Well, Elizabeth, I think we might wrap this up about here because we've gone for an hour 45. We've done pretty well tonight, and we've covered a lot of topics.
Yeah.
Man, this has been brilliant, like really brilliant. I've really enjoyed this episode. Hey, unfortunately, Jason's had to duck off. He's just sent a message saying that his son's gone come awake, which is you know, unfortunate. And yeah, he's sending his thanks as well, just saying thanks for coming on as well. But before we do wrap it up here, did you just want to like shout out any social media or anything you got going so people can come and give you a follow and, you know, see your awesome Lacie enclosure build and such?
Yeah. So just Chiquito's Critters on Facebook. I'm mainly active on Facebook compared to Instagram. I may be young, but Instagram is a whole new thing for me. I like the Facebook a bit better. And then even if you just search up Brisbane Reptile Society, that's with all your expo updates and things like that. On my personal page on Chiquito's Critters, I will be posting everything with the expo as well. But the Brisbane Reptile Society is the main expo page on Facebook, all on Facebook.
So. Oh, easy done. Well, yeah, as I said, thank you so much for coming on. No doubt we'll touch base again in the future, you know, and, you know, if you have any more projects or anything like that you want to come on and have a yarn about or whatever, you're more than welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. I love being on. Thanks so much for inviting me on. And, yeah, as I told you earlier, I was so excited to be on. So thank you again.
Oh, we're excited to have you on. And, yeah, I'll keep saying it. You know, thanks for coming on and being one of our you know, first females on the program. It's good to finally get some female representation in the hobby, yes. You know, out there under the airways, I think. So,
yeah, exactly.
Really stoked. All right, guys, so we'd like to say a massive thank you to Eric and Owen and the rest of the MPI crew for having us. If you'd like to contact them, it's best to find them at moreliapythonradio.com and email them at info@moreliapythonradio.com. Make sure to follow MPI Network on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. As far as contacting us in our social media platforms, you can email us at australianherpetoculture@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram as well. Make sure to check out our Teespring store for podcast merch. The link is on the Facebook page. To see more of what Jason is doing, make sure to follow him on Facebook and Instagram at The Gecko Effect. And for myself, you can find me everywhere on the internet at Beach of Scary Beasts. We hope to have you back next week for another episode of the Australian Herpetoculture Podcast. Good night, everyone.